He saw me even coaching ball.
This is a tape of Molly Sklut on December 21st, 1977.
Yeah, we're going to start now. Got the Y players in there and choral group. Oh, and I must tell you about our Boy Scout troop. Back in the, when they had the Y at the 3rd and King Street, they had Troop 28. And when Mr. Solid came, we reactivated that troop and they allowed us to keep the same number. And so we had the Boy Scout troop. And I'm not too positive, but I know he was a leader at one time. Louis Krestel, Dr. Louis Krestel. He was our Boy Scout leader. And also, now I don't know whether Joe Weiner was before he was or vice versa. And then we started a Girl Scout troop. And her name is Mrs. Morris Rosen now. Now, what the hell was her first name? It wasn't Rita. It'll come to me. Her last name was Eisman. And she had the Girl Scout troop. And people would call up, and they had little children, and they wanted them to join a Girl Scout troop. And I said, sure, they could all join. Mm-hmm. But after they all came, I found out that there was an age level involved. And we did not want to lose these children since we had them there. And so we went to the Girl Scout headquarters and found out there was such a thing as the Brownies. And I'm almost positive that we had the first Brownie troop in the city of Wilmington. And I don't remember who led that group, but Reba Sapowith was chairman of our Girl Scout committee with myself and Sadie Tumarkin. I'm positive that we had the first Brownie troop in the city. They said there was a program that hadn't started yet. And so we had the kids in there. Meanwhile, I kept the kids, yeah. You know? And then we put on a play. with the two troops, the Girl Scout and the Boy Scout troops, had pictures of it someplace too. And it was beautiful. And we all took part in coaching it, including myself, who never had a dancing lesson in my life. I was teaching them while Manny Klein was singing May Wine as on the stage. It was like a little musical. And he sang May Wine, and I taught the little girls how to dance. No, this had to be before that. This was in the 30s. It had to be in the 30s. Because once we got involved in the 40s with the war work, we didn't have too much time then. And by that time, we had Morris Levenberg to take care of different things, you know. And
I was going to say, because I had found some film.
Yeah.
Somebody had a movie camera taking film of a Boy Scout troop.
No, well, the Boy Scout troop was there for years. Oh, it didn't stop. The troop went on and on and on. And even, I think, when Mr. Bluestein was there, we still had our Boy Scout troop, and the war was over by then. Now, we didn't drop that. As a matter of fact, we assigned a room up on the third floor. It was a small room as the Boy Scout room, and they kept all their equipment up there because every once in a while they went camping, just like we took the girls out to Grantland. Now, Grant's 5 and 10 used to be in Wilmington. Mr. Grant had some property out around, I think it was Hokesson, and he gave that to the Girl Scouts. And we would take the girls out on a picnic and spend the whole day out there. And the Girl Scout Troop Committee would go, like Reba Sapp with Sadie Tumarkin and myself, and we used their transportation to take the kids out. And we have a cookout and be able to go into the house there and use the utensils. And I think we were allowed to use it for weekends. And then we asked parents to go along with them, too. Now, we really had a good club program there. We really did. I think because of the way we conducted the Y in those years is why we have a good program even up to today. Because it may have been a small center, but it was a most active center. And it was constantly busy, constantly. And we had plenty of kids there. And nobody paid for anything. They paid their membership dues, and that was it. Because if we had a program, and it cost us $150, and if we, when they had the blue laws, they stopped us from selling tickets for our lectures, so we asked for silver offerings, and maybe we would collect, let's say, for a program $100, then we felt that we had a cheap program for $50 for a top-notch speaker, you know. So it was always a problem there, I mean, charging for anything on account of the blue laws, if it was held on a Sunday. Yeah. And, of course, when they went to the basketball game and dance, it was like 50 cents. So they could go downstairs and see the game. And that went for equipment for the basketball team. And they bought them, and we'd sell, the team themselves would sell chances and buy their uniforms. And they weren't a source of worry to us because they raised their own money, most of them. Because the Y was part of their way of life. It was a way of life for all of us. And this is where we all congregated, down at the center. It had nothing to do. You'd sit around and sit around the lounge and just sit around and talk, like in little groups. And that was a very important thing, too. But once we got into the 40s, then we got involved with the war work, because then they passed the draft law. And in the draft law, they were drafting the boys to Fort DuPont. It was a regular army camp. And they were in for a six-month period. And after 6 months, they went back to their hometown again. And we had a lot of Jewish boys from New York there. And they found their way up to the YMHA because they were used to going to a YMHA in New York. And we had a terrible time. They had the girls in Wilmington accept them because during, way before the war, you know, it was only, they used to feel that these people weren't the right kind of men in the army, that they had, they were just kept off the street by going into the army. Mm-hmm. But when they start drafting in the boys, it could have been anybody's brother, anybody's part of their family or relative that was going to be in the service. And so it was a problem getting the girls to accept these fellas. And we had to go from, we had fraternities and sororities, I think I mentioned that before. They were high school age level, and we went around telling them that this is what's going to happen because your brother's going to go too. And then when they activated them into the army, then they start taking our boys. And they were going, the boys that were originally at Fort DuPont that came from New York and so were called right back to Fort DuPont again into the army, regular army. And so we had a nucleus to work with right down there. And after that, they start building the Newcastle Army Air Base, the Dover Army Air Base, the ammunition dumped down in Milford. And then it was our responsibility to see what we could do for those fellas. The snack lounge that we started, even though there was a USO, we took over a couple of rooms, and Saul Cohen sent some of his men up to the, from his carpentry department of the Allied Kid Company, and he made a snack lounge and put the counter. We made a little kitchen in there, and Mrs. Blattman, Mrs. Harry Braunstein, Mrs. Glyberg, especially Hanukkah time, they were there making potato latkes, and we took good care of our kids, and they always had corned beef and lox and cream cheese and bagel, the kind of stuff that they were used to at home, and we wanted them to have it. They were welcome. We didn't take any business away. We had Gentile boys that came down, they said, because we had better food. Had a beautiful snack lounge down there. It was just beautiful. And that was due to Saul Cohen. He was the one that did it. And he, at that time, was chairman of our Army and Navy Committee, and Mrs. Braunstein was the assistant chairman. But nobody ever wanted to go to the meetings, and so I was elected to go to the meetings at the camp. And there were times So I went down, and in the rec department, we used to go, oh, that came later. That was the hospital. No. Huh? Well, but this was after the war. See, after the war was over, they used the part of the Fort DuPont for the boys to hospitalize some of our boys. And then they moved them from there because they took over the Newcastle Army Air Base. And, of course, we went down there, too. But Joe Crow became the first, what did they call him? The recreational director? No, the VAVS, and that's the Voluntary Administration, VA Service Committee. And he was their first director for that. And he called on the Y because he worked there while he was down at the University of Delaware before Johnny Russo. And he asked if we participate in the program. And he says, Molly, kids have birthdays down there. How about doing something for us? I said, sure, anything you want. So I called Saul Cohen up. He says, go ahead, do it. And I went and ordered a birthday cake and sent it down. And then we, a few times they called on me if I would come down. They were taking fellas to the Arden to see shows. And would I come down and act as director of their recreational program? All I had to do was make sure that everything was in place and that nobody was out of line in the rec room. And I always had somebody else with me. And when everything was being closed up, and we started to go down to Bainbridge, and Reba Sapowith then became our chairman of our Army and Navy Committee, and I was her assistant. And we went down there, I think, once a month, too. And we'd take girls. And someplace here, I have a letter from Eugene Borowitz, who was the chaplain. And when my father passed away, he sent me a very beautiful letter because I had quite a write-up in the newspaper when my pop passed away. He had been president of the synagogue, and he blew the chauffeur there and so forth and so on. And he saw that in the news journal, and so he sent me a very lovely letter telling me how sorry that he and his assistant were that I had lost my father. So that's when, and I told you once before about the once a month in the Girls Service Council was organized during the war years, and where they were girls 18 years and over, where I took these girls with me to the army camps where they could help entertain the boys. And we were in the rec hall, and they danced with the boys. And we served refreshments. And my Mrs. Blattman was there. And Mrs. Bronstein occasionally went with us, too, to serve refreshments. Sometimes there were special programs that the Army camp themselves had organized, like Cal Basie was coming through a Coca-Cola company. And they called me and asked me to bring girls. Although USO brought them, they wanted me to come down with my girls, and would I take over the refreshments? And we did. What time is it, kid? No, it's all right. At 4 o'clock, she has to start undressing me and get my dinner ready for me. I used to eat 7 o'clock and 4 o'clock. Huh? 12. What can I do? And then she's leaving me, you know. And then she'll be here the after the 6th of January. I'm getting this, the Monday after the 6th, and I'm getting a new lady in here that will be working not with an agency, you know, privately. She'll be a housekeeper. The following week, I have to give her a day off because I have to go to Ruskin. Oh, thank God. I think I may have somebody to drive us up. I was talking to Frances Goldstein today, and she said that I got cancer. I don't have tires. No. I must tell you that it was very hard to get gasoline. You had to have coupons, and you had to have a priority to get tires for your automobile. And this Solid was running his car back and forth down to Dover, down to the Newcastle Army Air Base, down to Dover Army Air Base. And every Friday, either he or I went to a camp. But the Friday I went, I brought refreshments and I brought the girls. The Friday he went, he conducted the service. Our work was purely through the chaplain's office. And it got to the point where his tires were ready to blow out, and he just didn't know how he was going to get new tires. And I said, the Jewish Welfare Board.
No, when I moved it, it's okay. It's okay.
Yeah. You think that part got in there? And I was very insistent that if he didn't write to the Jewish Welfare Board for tires, that I was going to write to the Jewish Welfare Board for tires, because he wouldn't be able to go if he didn't get those tires, or at least get the priority to buy the tires. And so he just did not, so out of his own pocket, he bought tires with the priority from the Jewish Welfare Board. And,
huh?
Oh, yeah, sure he did. Just like I paid for stamps. And then I had that telephone committee that I, if I knew a fellow was in the hospital, that I would call. And I, people would run in and say, here, Ma, here's $5, here's $10. One of my best contributors was Esther Gross. That was Alma Gross's wife. If she'd be down in the farmer's market, she'd run in and say, here's some money for your telephone committee. And I would line up. We used the pay station so that we wouldn't have it on our Y bill. And I'd line up all their friends, you know, have about 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 boys that this fella would know, or girls, and let everybody talk to the person that was in the hospital. But, of course, we did nothing without clearing it with Mr. Solid, who was our director. And, of course, he made the original contacts with the camps, and then we worked it from there. So often we would have a man come in from the national JWB to review our work, and which they thought was very outstanding. And as a matter of fact, at one of the Federation dinners, Dr. Barsky, who was stationed at Camp Edward up in Massachusetts, got up and said that even all the way up in Massachusetts, he heard about the work we were doing from the YMHA in Wilmington, because boys had been transferred from down around Delaware up there to Massachusetts, and it was commendable, the type of work that we were doing. No, where should we go from here? Yeah.
He did write so much.
Well, I don't say that he wrote so much, but so did the other boys write as much. It's just like Joe Weiner then was our Boy Scout leader, and he couldn't hear. He was hard of hearing. And we were so sure that they wouldn't take him, but they did. And he had to go, and when he was overseas and he was wounded and he was in the hospital, when he was examined, even the doctors there said he wrote, wanted to know what he was doing there. He couldn't even hear a gun explode. He could get killed. There were so many stories that were so that were outstanding. Or when my cousin Aaron was walking through the woods in France and he ran into one of the boys from Wilmington. Aaron was in the Air Force, and the other fellow was just an Army. I can't offhand, I could always find out who the fellow was, but he ran into a couple of boys from Wilmington. He was taking a walk in the woods out in France. Or the time that Peeny Berger was wounded, and he was in the hospital, at the same hospital was Marvin Lazarus. And I wrote to Rabbi Tavel. I knew he was within that vicinity. I would never know. But as I said once before, through the APOs, I had an idea just about where they were stationed. And I asked Tavel, and I think there's a picture there. And also, Peeny Berger's brother, who was a doctor, Cy, got to see him. And I think I have a small picture there of Cy with his brother. And then there also should be a picture of where the two Tannen brothers met in, I think it was in Italy too, and Rabbi Tavel was there. And, I used to carry the letters with me sometimes. I got, you know, bundles of letters, and I take some of them home every night with me. And so when I would go to the air base or while services were on and being conducted, I'd sit in the back of the room and I'd read, and I'll never forget when I opened the letter and a picture fell out, and it was a letter from Morris Arif, who was a photographer in the Air Force, and where Seymour Berman got married, and he sent me a picture of the wedding, and nobody in Wilmington knew he got married. I had the picture of the wedding.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
It really was good. They accepted it. And this wasn't our boy, but a couple of incidents of down at the Newcastle Army Air Base. There was a Lieutenant Diamond, offhand I don't remember his first name, handsome fella. And at the dances, we weren't supposed to have any officers there, just the enlisted men, and he pleaded with me to let him go. He says, I'll dance with the girls, I'll dance with the fat ones, I'll dance with the ones that wear glasses and don't look so good. He says, just let me come in there too. And finally I broke down and I allowed him to come in. And whenever I went to the camp, I always had a list, and I got them through the chaplains of all the Jewish boys that were stationed in all the camps. I would send out a card like a week in the Monday in advance before I was coming down to let them know that I was coming and to make sure that they would attend the services, and then we'd have the dance. And the dance was for the whole camp. It wasn't just for the Jewish boys. And then one time the card came back and it was marked deceased, and I was just horrified. And all I kept saying, he's dead, he's dead, he's dead. And Mr. Solid says, well, but who's dead? What are you talking about? He's dead. I says, look at this, it's marked deceased. And he was an only child, an only son. And I didn't know his parents. I would have written had I known. And then another incident at Fort DuPont, where I think I told you where the boy came in and they were scheduled to be shipped overseas. How he ever got out, I don't know, but he ran into the center that night, gave me all these bonds, and then I sent him on to his parents in New York. And then I also got a notification from the chaplain, the Fort DuPont, that he was killed. And when the war was over, and Miss Kixman came to work for us, that was after Solid left, we were sending out the recorder. We used to fold each one by hand and put the stickers on by hand. And I was sitting with Miss Kixman, and this fellow walks in, and he was a Jewish boy, but we used to call him Murphy. And he says, hi, Molly. And I looked at him, and I didn't even answer him. And I kept on working, and Miss Kixman says to me, Molly, that fellow's talking to you. And I looked up at him, and I looked down again, and I looked up again, and I says, it just can't be because he's dead. I says, I know he's dead, because the chaplain told me he's dead. And he says, it's me. What had happened was that they had to retreat, and he got into a barn, and they were taken prisoner, and it was in the newspapers, and they took the American uniforms and their dog tags off. And of course, he was missing in action, and so after a certain time, they declared him dead. After the war was over, he was alive. And it was just unbelievable to see a man that you knew was dead walk in on you, you know, and say, it's me. And I say, no, you're dead. It was laughable. I tell you, I sat there in tears full of that face. horrible. It was just, they were terrible days. We had, I have one picture there of Eugene Sigmund. See, I have my whole wall in my office was completely covered with pictures. And then in the lounge, the back wall was all completely covered with pictures because every fellow that went sent a picture, and we had them blown up. And then Rosenbaum's had the big store on Market Street, and they said, Molly, we'll sell you picture frames wholesale. So they were very inexpensive, and I always had some kind of a fund. And I used to buy a lot of, like, a gross of frames at one time. And there was one that used to hang over the office door, and any time I was blue or felt very upset, I look up at that picture of Eddie Honey and Eugene Sigmund, and they looked like two little boys in sailor suits, and I used to burst right out laughing. They were my morale builders, those two, that one picture. One day it disappeared. They hated it, and I think they took it away from me, but I had another one made. It was just great. And then one wall, I faced one wall, and I had the whole basketball team on that. With, in the center, I had Franny Walsh. He was a Catholic fella. And he got us into the Catholic League, and he was in the center of all of them. And it was because of all of our fellas leaving that he enlisted in service. He didn't have to, Franny. He was with the DuPont Company in charge of transportation, and he traveled with the Army. And because as a civilian, he could answer back where an Army man couldn't. But the DuPont Company loaned him to the Army, and he would travel with somebody by plane to wherever they had problems in transportation, and he would travel with them, but then he finally enlisted. And then I used Alvin Fine, Rabbi Fine. He was here. And then he said he had to get into the service. And I'll never forget when and he was right too, he gave them a sermon over at the Newcastle Army Air Base. And he says, don't think when the war is over that you're just going to drop all these uniforms. It's not going to be that easy. He says, because we'll still be wearing the uniform. And then one day he called me up. He says, meet me at Rubens for lunch. That's where Gamil's is now. And I met him for lunch. And he says, Molly, I'm going into service. Because he told me if they don't give me a chaplaincy, I'm going in as a buck private. I just feel I have to go. And so he told me, it was his insignia, chaplain's insignia that I had, which I would like to get back, just like I'd like to get the other chaplain's insignia, the cross back. Because I know that they never had no cross. So these are the things that are very important to me.
Yeah, I did write to the National Jewish Welfare Board.
Yeah, but you probably got nothing.
I just wrote.
Oh, did you?
A week and a half ago, and they typed it up, and also we should be hearing something.
They have to track him down, because the last I heard, I had him tracked down as far as California. Mm-hmm. Now somebody there has to know what happened to this man, even if they have a. An office. If the Jewish Welfare Board has an office in California, they should be able to track this man down. They have to. And see, everybody said they were going to do it. Rabbi Geffen was going to do it. What's his name? He's now dead. Ben Sharon was our field secretary that came in. He was going to do that, and nobody really followed through on it. And as Geffen said, he knew Diane Corin, and but it just, maybe they asked her and that's the end of it. Nobody knew. But somebody had it, because he was going to show it to the Jewish Welfare Board. And I had a feeling I wasn't going to get them back. And I gave it to him. I took him back about three times. And he says, they should be seen. Well, if they're being seen someplace, I want them back for the Historical Society, because that's where they belong. Yeah, yeah. But as I told Tony, I says, if you have to use Stuart, I think Stuart as a lawyer should, get involved in this. She says, oh, he'd like that.
Yeah.
ask another question. Well, Mr. Solid graduated as an attorney.
Oh.
He was an attorney at law. He practiced for a short time, and he just didn't care for it because he says he just couldn't feel that he could go in and defend somebody that he thought was guilty. But while he was going to school, he did work as a club worker at the JEA in Baltimore. And that's how he got into the social workers field. And then he worked in Washington as a